Hello everyone, this is Robin Warder, and for personal reasons, I had to take some time off from the podcast, so instead of releasing a new episode this week, we're going to drop one of our older Patreon bonus episodes into our feed. This episode was originally released 4 years ago, and the featured case is best known for being a final appeal segment on Unsolved Mysteries, as it covers the controversial conviction of Larry Race for the 1982 murder of his wife, Debbie Race, and he always maintained that her death was a tragic accident rather than a homicide. As an aside, if you want to hear more content like this, you can visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold and sign up for tiers 2 or 3, where we have around 80 exclusive bonus episodes from both The Trail Went Cold and The Path Went Chilly in our archives, and some of these episodes explore other final appeal cases which were featured on Unsolved Mysteries. Anyway, we'll go back to releasing new episodes starting next Wednesday, March the 29th, but until then, I hope you enjoy hearing the full story behind the final appeal of Larry Race. May 11th, 1982. Duluth, Minnesota. 33-year-old married couple Larry and Debbie Race celebrate their 14th wedding anniversary by taking their boat out onto Lake Superior for an evening cruise. Hours later, Larry calls for help and claims they evacuated the boat together in a life raft but became separated. Debbie's body is soon found washed up on shore, and her cause of death is determined to be hypothermia. However, since the life raft cannot be found, and a number of discrepancies open up in Larry's story, authorities suspect foul play and eventually charge him with Debbie's murder. Larry is convicted and receives a life sentence, but even after being paroled 22 years later, he maintains that Debbie's death was an accident, and debate remains about his guilt or innocence. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to this month's bonus Patreon episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be chronicling another final appeal case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1982 death of Debbie Race and the subsequent conviction of her husband, Larry Race. As you probably know, I've already done a couple of Patreon episodes about these final appeal stories where the cases were technically solved, but there was doubt about whether the right person was convicted of the crime. As a result, I've received numerous requests to cover the story of Larry and Debbie Race, and it's quite a unique case. It involves a man who was sent to prison for the murder of his wife, even though he maintained that her death was not actually a murder at all, but a tragic accident. This case is somewhat reminiscent of the Kathleen Peterson staircase murder, in which her husband was convicted of killing her, but claimed that she died from an accidental fall down the stairs. However, this story is a bit more complex, because even though there are definitely good reasons to be suspicious of Larry Race, taking your wife out onto a lake and arranging things so that she'd die of hypothermia without any noticeable signs of foul play is a pretty convoluted way to kill someone. And even if that is what actually happened, there's always been question about whether Larry's guilt was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Larry never stopped maintaining his innocence and was paroled after serving 22 years in prison, so this case is definitely closed for good. But there will always be debate about whether he was convicted of a non-existent murder. So in this episode, we're going to look at both sides of the argument and try and determine whether justice really was served here. Anyway, without any further ado, let us now discuss the controversial conviction of Larry Race. Our story begins in Minnesota in 1982. Our central figures are 33-year-old Larry Race and his 33-year-old wife Debbie, who live in the town of Hoyt Lakes with their three daughters. May 11th just happened to be the couple's 14th wedding anniversary, so they would celebrate the evening by driving to Duluth to have dinner at Lakeview Castle, a restaurant which overlooked the north shore of Lake Superior. After dinner, the Races went to the nearby Knife River Marina to take their boat, a 22-foot cabin cruiser known as the Jenny Lee, out on Lake Superior for an evening cruise, where they would listen to music and look at the lights from the city in the distance. However, at around 9 p.m., when they were about a mile offshore, things started to go horribly wrong. Now, the information I'm about to share with you is Larry Race's version of events. According to Larry, the boat started to take on water, and when he took off the engine cover, he noticed there was a leak in the water jacket as the result of a bolt which came loose. This prompted him to turn the engine off, and he was able to repair the leak, but the problem was that the engine would not start again, presumably because it had been flooded. Larry tried to use the bilge pump to remove the water which was now on the floor, but it made a loud sucking noise, which made Debbie think the pump was pulling the floor loose. Since Debbie could not swim, and was known for having a fear of the water, she became hysterical and began to panic, before she told Larry she wanted to leave the boat. There was a reason to be concerned, as the Jenny Lee had actually gone through a similar situation the previous summer, when it struck a reef and sank to the bottom of Lake Superior. On that particular occasion, Larry was on the boat with two of their daughters, but he managed to load them onto a life raft and tow them safely to shore. So Larry was going to attempt the same thing again with Debbie. He grabbed a life raft and inflated it, while Debbie put on a life jacket and placed her purse, valuables, and Larry's shoes inside a gear bag. Larry then put on a dry suit, while Debbie climbed into the raft. Since Larry was a strong swimmer, his plan was to jump in the water and pull Debbie and the raft to shore. On this particular night, the water's temperature was only 37 degrees, so after swimming and dragging the raft through the lake for a while, Larry told Debbie he was developing cramps and needed to get into the raft with her. However, while attempting to climb inside, the raft had trouble supporting Larry's weight and started taking on water, so Debbie told him to remain in the lake. Since Larry had not brought along his diving gloves, his hands were very cold, so he started rubbing them together for warmth, causing him to lose his grip on the raft. As the raft drifted away, Larry saw what appeared to be some lights in the distance from a boat. Larry yelled at Debbie that he would swim over to this boat to get help while she remained in the raft, and then he would return for her. Anyway, Larry said that he swam towards the lights, but was disappointed to realize that he had actually been looking at the Jenny Lee and only managed to swim back to his own boat. But now that he was there, Larry decided to give the engine another try, and this time, it actually started. Larry then fired off some flares before he took the Jenny Lee around the lake to search for his wife. Unfortunately, he was unable to find any sign of Debbie or the raft, so he took the boat to shore and went to a nearby motel to call for help. The Coast Guard were notified and would go out onto Lake Superior, but even though they spent the rest of the night searching for Debbie, they had no luck finding her either. But shortly before 4 p.m. on the afternoon of May 12th, a teenage boy found Debbie's body washed up on shore near London Road, a location which was miles southwest of the search area. Debbie was still wearing her life jacket, and her cause of death was eventually determined to be immersion hypothermia. On the surface, it seemed like Debbie was the victim of a tragic accident, but it wasn't long before the authorities started to become suspicious of Larry and the story he shared. For starters, the Race's marriage had been a rocky one, as it turned out that Larry had issues with infidelity and conducted extramarital affairs with no fewer than four different women in the preceding years. In fact, one of these affairs had been going on until the very weekend before Debbie's death. In spite of this, Larry claimed that he and Debbie were working things out to save the marriage, and that their 14th anniversary celebration had been intended as a fresh start. But it was also discovered that Larry had purchased $108,000 worth of insurance policies on Debbie's life only 7 months earlier. In addition, Larry was experiencing financial problems, as he had a passion for diving, and often went on expeditions to search for shipwrecks at the bottom of Lake Superior, but this hobby was also costly and had put him into debt. These revelations prompted authorities to dig deeper into Larry's story about the circumstances of his wife's death. Right from the outset, they questioned his decision to abandon the boat inside the life raft, particularly since Larry had such an extensive knowledge of boating and diving. After boarding the Jenny Lee, they did discover a minor leak in the engine and a few inches of water in the hull, but they found no indication that the boat had been in any real danger of sinking, as the bilge pump could have easily pumped out the remaining water. There was also a troubling discrepancy in Larry's timeline. Even though Larry claimed the troubles with the Jenny Lee started sometime after 9 p.m., he did not actually call for help until around 2:30 a.m. Well, Larry tried to explain this large window of time by claiming that after he swam away from Debbie in a life raft and made it back on board the Jenny Lee, he immediately passed out from exhaustion for a couple of hours before he woke up, restarted the engine, and took the boat back to shore. In his original statement, Larry denied having brought any scuba gear on board the Jenny Lee until a witness came forward and claimed they'd seen Larry loading a scuba tank onto the boat at the Knife Point Marina at around 7:30 p.m., right before he and Debbie went out onto the water. Larry then changed his story and said he did bring a scuba tank along with him and had placed it in the life raft with Debbie before they left the boat in case they needed it for an emergency. However, neither the scuba tank, as well as the gear bag containing Debbie's purse and Larry's shoes, was ever found. But most distressingly, the actual life raft itself could not be found. Now, a life raft was found on the Jenny Lee, which had 5 cuts and punctures on it. According to Larry, he always kept 2 life rafts aboard the boat. He attempted to inflate the first raft, but after noticing there were some holes in it, he decided to inflate the second one instead and told Debbie to climb into it. Larry initially denied that the raft found on the boat had ever been in the lake, but investigators noticed that several gallons of water were still in it. Once again, Larry changed his story and now claimed that he had tossed the raft over the side into the lake when he discovered there were holes in it and brought it back on board after he swam back to the boat later on. But this story only opened up another troubling discrepancy. The caps to the raft's air chambers were securely closed. In order to have attempted to inflate the raft like he said, Larry would have needed to open the air chambers, so it seemed pretty odd that he would go to the trouble of closing them again before tossing the raft over the side. There was also suspicion about the fact that the 5 cuts and punctures on the raft were all located at the bottom and had severed both of the air chambers. The evidence seemed to suggest that the cuts had been made intentionally while the raft was already fully inflated. And since an additional life raft could not be found anywhere in Lake Superior, the authorities began to believe that Debbie had actually been inside the life raft found on board the Jenny Lee, and the second raft Larry described did not actually exist. In other words, this unfortunate series of events which took Debbie's life was actually an elaborate murder plot. As a result, the St. Louis County Sheriff's Department started building a case against Larry and sent it to a grand jury, and in April of 1983, he was formally indicted with first-degree murder. Larry would go on trial in late October of that year, and the case was prosecuted by St. Louis County Attorney John DeSanto. The prosecution's theory was that Larry had dreamed up a plot to murder his wife and make her death look like an accident because he wanted to escape an unhappy marriage and cash in on Debbie's life insurance. 2 of the women Larry had conducted affairs with would testify that he often complained that Debbie was overweight, spent too much money, and was a bad housekeeper. In fact, shortly after Debbie's death, Larry had contacted both of these women and told them that if they were ever questioned by police, they should say they were nothing more than friends. As mentioned earlier, Larry was incredibly passionate about scuba diving and dove in Lake Superior an average of 40 times per year, and this hobby would have allowed him to acquire quite a bit of knowledge of immersion hypothermia. At trial, John DeSanto presented a scenario where Larry took Debbie out onto the lake and tricked her into getting into the life raft by telling her the boat was sinking, which would require him to drag the raft ashore, much like he had done with her 2 daughters the previous summer. Larry then put on his scuba gear and dragged Debbie and the raft a great distance away from the Jenny Lee before he proceeded to swim underneath the raft and slashed it with a knife, severing the air chambers. As a result, the raft deflated and Debbie wound up in the freezing water, where she eventually succumbed to hypothermia. Larry then dragged the deflated raft back to the Jenny Lee and concocted a fake story to feed to the authorities after he went back to shore and called for help. Larry had on a dry suit while carrying this plan out, which would have allowed him to swim in 37-degree water for an extended period of time without developing hypothermia. Of course, given the complicated nature of this alleged murder, the prosecution's case against Larry would be very circumstantial, but they brought in an expert to testify that the cuts in the bottom of the raft would likely have been made by an upward thrust with a knife while underwater. A number of tests were also performed to rule out the possibility that these cuts could have been caused by jagged rocks. However, an issue for the prosecution was that they were unable to produce a knife which could be conclusively established as having slashed the raft. A steak knife was found inside a toolbox on the Jenny Lee, but it did not match the puncture marks on the raft, and there were no traces of rubber on it either. While Larry was known for owning two diving knives, neither of them could be found on the boat and were unaccounted for. The crux of the prosecution's case was the lack of evidence to support Larry's story that he had two life rafts on board the Jenny Lee. Search and rescue teams from the Coast Guard spent days searching for the second raft in Lake Superior, but failed to locate it. The case garnered substantial coverage in the local media, asking anyone to come forward if they found a discarded raft anywhere in the area, but no one ever did. Members of the search and rescue team would testify that if this raft had existed, they certainly would have found it, since life rafts were manufactured to be unsinkable. Many of Larry's friends and diving companions would be called upon to testify that they could not recall ever having seen more than one raft on board the Jenny Lee at any time. As you recall, the Jenny Lee had sank to the bottom of Lake Superior in the summer of 1981, but Larry had the boat raised to the surface and began repair work on it. On May 7, 1982, 4 days before Debbie's death, he fitted the boat with a rebuilt engine, but claimed there were issues with the exhaust manifold bolt. While this caused a slow drip-type leak in the engine, it did not appear to pose any risk, and the boat and engine seemed to work well on the water without the leak worsening. The following day, several of Larry's friends accompanied him on a diving expedition, the first time the Jenny Lee was used for this since the sinking. None of these witnesses reported experiencing any issues with the boat, nor did they recall seeing two life rafts on board. The only witness who could testify to the possible existence of a second raft was one of Larry's daughters, who claimed she had seen two life rafts in her family's garage prior to her mother's death. The defense also called upon a sheriff's deputy to testify, who had spoken with Larry 3 days before the Jenny Lee sank. The deputy claimed that Larry had stopped him and asked him to perform a safety inspection of the boat, and while the deputy declined, he did provide Larry with a list of safety equipment that was required by state law to be on the boat. Larry then responded by mentioning that he had two life rafts on board, though the deputy could not actually confirm having seen them. However, the prosecution would claim that the deputy's testimony was inconsistent and unreliable, as when he was initially questioned shortly after Debbie's death, he claimed to know nothing about two rafts. Another key witness for the defense was Jean Obineau, an underwater expert from the University of Minnesota who worked as a diving instructor. He attempted to debunk the prosecution scenario, testifying that it would have required superhuman strength and been physically impossible for Larry to have pulled off all the tasks he was accused of doing when he murdered his wife. On the night this took place, witnesses had reported seeing the Jenny Lee's lights near the mouth of the Talmadge River between 8:30 and 9:30 p.m., the approximate time period when Larry claimed he and Debbie exited the boat in the life raft. However, Debbie's body was eventually found washed up on shore 7 miles west of this location at around 4 p.m. the following day. Obineau testified that Debbie's body would not have been able to drift to the spot where she was found during this 19-hour window unless she had been in a raft for a long period of time. Since Debbie was wearing a life jacket, Obineau believed she would have only been able to float a maximum of 1 or 2 miles before she washed up on shore. Well, the prosecution's rebuttal to this was that even though the Jenny Lee was seen near the Talmadge River at around 9 p.m., they technically only had Larry's word that Debbie left the boat at this particular point in time, as there were no other witnesses who could corroborate seeing Larry, Debbie, or the raft in the water that night. Obineau also testified that Debbie's skin lividity seemed to support the idea that she had been in a life raft when she made it to shore. Her blood had not sunk to her feet when she was found, which should have happened if she had been in the water for an extended period of time, since her life jacket would have kept her in an upward position. However, the prosecution claimed that the levels of Debbie's skin lividity showed she had been floating on her back for a long time, and this was the same position her body was in when it was found on shore. The defense would produce numerous character witnesses to testify on Larry's behalf, who spoke highly of him and did not believe he was capable of murder. Larry and Debbie's three daughters all expressed their belief that their father was innocent, and surprisingly, Debbie's parents, Frank and Sylvia Selvey, stood by him as well. Even though the Selveys were aware of Larry's infidelity, they offered their unwavering public support for him and genuinely believed that their daughter's death was an accident. In fact, during the trial, the judge actually asked the Selveys to leave the courtroom because they were interacting with Larry and openly embracing him during recesses, and the judge felt this might unfairly influence the jury. Well, in spite of this, the jury ultimately believed the prosecution's version of events. After 12 hours of deliberation, they found Larry guilty of first-degree murder. He was given a life sentence at Stillwater State Prison in Minneapolis, with no possibility of parole for at least 17 years. During the trial, on the advice of his attorneys, Larry never took the stand and testified on his own behalf. Larry felt that the verdict may have been different if he had been allowed to testify, and came to believe that he had received inadequate counsel. As a result, he hired a team of defense attorneys who appealed his conviction. There were allegations that the jury had discussed Larry's decision not to testify during their deliberations, even though the judge had specifically instructed them not to do this. If true, this would have been a violation of Minnesota law and his Fifth Amendment rights, and may have unfairly influenced their verdict. Larry also believed that since the jury was made up of 4 men and 8 women, they may have been unfairly prejudiced by his extramarital affairs. A hearing was held in which jurors were questioned about this, but the trial judge ultimately decided that there was no jury misconduct and Larry had received a fair trial, so he upheld the conviction. Larry's original defense attorney would later say that Larry did not even want to testify at the trial, and once flat out said, quote, "You can't make me." They ultimately decided that it was not a good idea to put Larry on the stand, since he had trouble giving direct answers to any questions which made him look bad. In 1985, there would be another appellate hearing based on new information from a witness who came forward. This person had purchased the Jenny Lee in the years following Debbie's death, and claimed that in May of 1984, he experienced problems starting the engine. An independent mechanic was hired to examine the boat starter, who concluded that it was worn and could have caused an intermittent starting failure. The defense argued that this supported Larry's story, but since 2 years had passed, the state maintained that this did not prove that the Jenny Lee was experiencing the same problems with the starter on the night Debbie died. So once again, Larry's request for a new trial was denied. In spite of this, Larry's supporters would not stop fighting for him and kept his story in the spotlight, and the case eventually wound up being a final appeal segment on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries in December of 1991. After the broadcast, a pair of sisters came forward who claimed they had once found a discarded raft about a year or so after Debbie's death, and now believed it may have been the missing second raft from the Jenny Lee. At the time, they had not heard of the case and had no idea of the raft's potential significance, so one of these sisters wound up taking the raft home and cleaning it so that her children could play with it. She remembered storing the raft in her mother's basement several years earlier, but had no idea of its current whereabouts. Nonetheless, this revelation was used as grounds for a new appeal, and Larry's defense team filed another motion for a new trial. However, when a hearing was held, the testimony of the two sisters proved inconsistent, as they could not even be certain of the exact time period they found the raft, going back and forth between May of 1982 and 1983. They also had trouble pinpointing the exact location they found the raft, as one of the sisters initially said it was near Duluth, but then changed her story and said it was the St. Croix River, and clearly got confused about whether the raft was found in Minnesota or Wisconsin. As a result of these inconsistencies, it could not be conclusively proven if the raft these sisters had found was connected to the case, so their testimony was ultimately dismissed, and Larry's appeal was denied. He eventually exhausted all his appeals, but in 2005, Larry was finally granted parole and released from prison after serving 22 years. But he always maintained his innocence and denied killing his wife, so it remains up for debate whether Larry Ray spent 2 decades in prison for a murder which never happened. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. Or did it? There's a very famous line during the Unsolved Mystery segment when prosecutor John DeSanto is interviewed and says, quote, "I don't think this story is appropriate for Unsolved Mysteries because this is simply not an unsolved mystery." So I guess another question is this story not appropriate for The Trail Went Cold because the trail did not go cold? Well, whether you believe this case was properly solved, or you think there was nothing to solve to begin with, I can see why this would be an ideal case to cover as a Patreon bonus episode. If Larry is innocent, then there is no quote-unquote real killer to find, since Debbie's death would have been nothing more than an accident. Cases in which a defendant is prosecuted for murder, which they maintain was an accident, are really complex, because even if there's good reason to be suspicious, it's not always easy to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that foul play was involved. Stories in which husbands murder their wives and try to make it look like an accident are very popular on true crime shows, and I'm willing to bet that if Dateline had been around during the early 1980s, they would have been all over this case. Of course, like I mentioned in the intro, one of the most famous examples of this is the death of Kathleen Peterson, which was chronicled in the popular documentary series The Staircase. As you well know, Kathleen's husband, Michael Peterson, went to prison for murdering her, even though he maintained that she died from an accidental fall down the stairs. Of course, Michael Peterson's conviction was eventually overturned, not because he was proven innocent, but because one of the experts who testified for the prosecution was discredited, calling the entire case they presented at trial into question. In the end, Michael wound up entering an Alford plea in order to avoid going on trial again. So even if you think he was guilty all along, we'll probably never know the full truth about what actually happened. And the same type of issue pervades this case. Larry Race became a free man again, but he never actually got his name cleared. Even if he really was guilty of murdering his wife, there's some question about whether the crime actually happened in the same fashion the prosecution presented at trial. Larry pretty much fits the perfect stereotype of a husband who would commit a murder like this. He was unfaithful to his wife, he had financial problems, and he was set to inherit a substantial amount of life insurance following her death. But I think the main reason there's still a lot of debate surrounding this case is that if there was foul play involved, this would have been quite an unusual and complicated way to kill someone. I mean, it is really difficult to prove that someone is guilty of murder by hypothermia. All that being said, as interesting as many of the final appeal cases on Unsolved Mysteries were, they sometimes had a tendency to leave out pieces of information which made the appellant look guilty. Once you look at all the evidence in some of these cases, and see the full picture, it becomes apparent that the appellant was probably guilty all along. For a long time, I considered this to be one of the most difficult final appeal cases to make up my mind on, since the circumstances of how the victim died were so unusual. However, some of the more damning information I shared about Larry Race in this episode was conveniently not mentioned on Unsolved Mysteries. But I still want to explore this case from all angles, so let's not get ahead of ourselves. In Larry's defense, he does have a lot of supporters who described him as a kind, generous man whom they believed was incapable of murder. It's very interesting that even Debbie's own parents, Frank and Sylvia Selvey, stood by Larry and thought he was completely innocent of murdering their daughter. You often don't see that in these type of cases, and when the victim's family does support the accused, it's because they seem to be a model spouse. But here, the Selveys were standing by a guy who cheated on his wife with no less than 4 different women throughout their marriage. Regardless, they seem to think very highly of Larry, and even though the Selveys have since passed away, as far as I can tell, they never wavered in their support of him. However, that's the thing with sociopaths. They can be charming enough to fool anybody, and if Larry did murder his wife in such a cold, calculated fashion, then there's a pretty good chance he's a sociopath. So let's look at the circumstances of how these events played out. The way Larry tells it, Even though he was definitely guilty of adultery and the marriage had hit a rough patch, he was willing to change his ways and remain with Debbie, so this evening cruise on their 14th wedding anniversary was supposed to be a fresh start for them. In Larry's defense, unlike some other cases in which an unfaithful husband is accused of murdering their wife, it does not sound like he immediately hooked up with another woman following Debbie's death. But some of the women Larry had affairs with would testify that he constantly complained about his wife, so maybe he just really wanted out of the marriage without the inconvenience of a divorce. It does seem like quite an unfortunate coincidence that a tragic event like this would occur right after Larry told his wife he was willing to start over. Anyway, according to Larry, the engine sprung a leak while they were in the middle of Lake Superior, and while he was able to contain it, the engine wouldn't start again, and Debbie became so paranoid that the boat was going to sink that she convinced him to evacuate on a life raft. Now on the surface, this story might not seem too implausible. This was only a few days after Larry finished completing repairs on the boat after it sank the previous summer and refitted it with a new engine, so I can see why there would be issues with the engine leaking. Of course, it does seem like an overreaction for Debbie to panic and want to leave the boat over what seemed like a minor problem. If you're stranded in the middle of the lake, as long as the boat isn't sinking, it's much safer to remain there rather than trying to make your way to shore in a life raft in pitch black darkness. It might seem ridiculous that Debbie freaked out because the sound of the bilge pump scraping the floor made her think the boat was sinking, but keep in mind that Debbie could not swim, had a fear of the water, and knew the boat had already sank before, so I could totally see her getting worked up over something like this. But the thing I have trouble accepting is that Debbie would be able to convince Larry that climbing into a life raft was the best course of action. By all accounts, Larry was completely obsessed with boating and diving, and would have known that leaving the boat after sustaining such minimal damage was not a wise idea. His rationale was that Debbie was so panic-stricken that her fear wound up spreading to him and convinced him that the next logical step was putting on a dry suit, jumping into the water, and dragging Debbie and the life raft to safety. It's true that people will not always make the most logical decisions when they're in stressful situations, so you shouldn't automatically assume that Larry is guilty of murder just because he made a poor judgment call. But still, when the Coast Guard examined the Jenny Lee, they concluded that it was in no danger of sinking whatsoever. When Larry put his two daughters into a life raft and pulled them to safety several months earlier, that was after the boat had crashed into a reef and was clearly about to sink. So in other words, Larry had a frame of reference for judging how badly the Jenny Lee was damaged and whether an evacuation was necessary. Of course, I'm not sure the authorities would have taken this as an indicator of foul play if there weren't some other noticeable discrepancies. We have Larry initially claiming that he never brought scuba gear on board the Jenny Lee until a witness said they saw him loading a scuba tank onto the boat at the marina, prompting Larry to change his story and say that he did place scuba gear in the raft alongside Debbie. And this scuba gear, like many other items in the story, was not found anywhere in the lake. It seems like a very odd thing for Larry to lie about that, until you hear the prosecution's theory that he went underwater to cut the bottom of the life raft while Debbie was inside, which would have required him to wear scuba gear. So then you start realizing, if Larry was already putting on a dry suit to climb into the water to drag the raft ashore, why would he put the scuba gear inside the raft with Debbie? Why not just put it on if you're going to be in the water anyway? Another example of Larry suspiciously changing his story is when he mentioned making an attempt to inflate one of the rafts before he noticed there were holes in it, prompting them to leave the boat in the second life raft he had on board. Again, Larry denies putting this first raft into the lake until they discovered several gallons of water in it, so he adds another tweak to this story about tossing the raft over the side when he noticed the holes. Fair enough, but when Larry swam back to the Jenny Lee after separating from Debbie, would there really be any reason to retrieve the damaged raft and bring it back onto the boat with them? I think that if you were swimming for your life and your wife was in jeopardy, you wouldn't bother with something like that. And the other detail which made investigators suspicious was that the air chambers on this raft were securely closed. If Larry was attempting to inflate the raft and noticed there were holes in it, compelling him to toss the raft overboard, would he really go to the trouble of closing the air chambers again? This definitely gave off the impression that the raft was fully inflated at the time the cuts were made, meaning that Debbie was already inside when it happened. I previously mentioned that certain details about this case which pointed towards Larry's possible guilt were omitted from the Unsolved Mysteries segment, and, well, those tidbits about the scuba gear and the closed air chambers were among them. But the key piece of info they didn't share, which caused me to look at this case in a different light, was the timeline. The segment did mention that the problems with the engine leak allegedly started at around 9 p.m., but they did not say the exact time Larry made it to shore again and called for help. And once I found some of the case's legal appeals online and learned that Larry's call for help did not take place until after 2:30 a.m., a number of red flags went up. Now, Larry's explanation for this discrepancy is that once he made it back to the Jenny Lee after becoming separated from Debbie, he passed out from exhaustion for several hours before he managed to get the engine started again. The way Unsolved Mysteries framed it, you'd think that Larry immediately started the engine and went searching for Debbie after he boarded the boat and went to call for help when he couldn't find her. I don't know, it just seems like quite an unfortunate coincidence that Larry would pass out immediately after swimming back to his boat, but it's a fortunate coincidence that the engine just happened to start working again after he woke up. I mean, I'm sure swimming a great distance through the freezing cold water of Lake Superior is no picnic, but Larry had a ton of experience and did this type of thing all the time. It's also an unfortunate coincidence that a skilled diver like him would forget to bring his diving gloves along, which is what caused him to lose his grip on the raft and become separated from Debbie. One of the biggest issues with trying to figure out what really happened in this case is that there's a time period of over 5 hours when Larry and Debbie's whereabouts are completely unaccounted for. We do have witnesses who remembered seeing what appeared to be lights from the Jenny Lee near the Talmadge River between 8:30 and 9:30 p.m., and other witnesses who reported seeing flares being fired into the air at around 2 a.m. Larry confirmed that he fired those flares from the Jenny Lee while searching for Debbie, but this was after he'd supposedly been passed out for an extended period of time. At trial, one of the biggest key points pushed forward by the defense to support Larry's story was the fact that Debbie's body was found washed ashore 7 miles from the location where she allegedly left the boat. Jean Obedo testified that it would have been impossible for Debbie's body to drift that far on its own, and that without a raft, she only would have drifted a mile or two at the most before she washed ashore. So his argument was that Debbie likely became separated from the raft a relatively short distance from this spot. On the surface, this does seem like a plausible argument for Larry's innocence. We do have witnesses placing the Jenny Lee 7 miles away at around 9 p.m., the approximate time when Larry said the issues with the engine started, prompting him and Debbie to leave the boat and the raft. But here's the thing. We only have Larry's word that events actually unfolded that way. So technically, the only person who can corroborate that Debbie left the Jenny Lee near the mouth of the Talmadge River is an unreliable narrator. And if Larry is lying, then Jean Obedo's testimony does not mean anything. The fact of the matter is that the Jenny Lee could have been at an entirely different location at an entirely different time when Debbie first entered the water. If she succumbed to hypothermia only about a mile or two away from the spot where she was found, then her body could have easily drifted there and washed ashore before it was discovered the following afternoon. We have a period of over 5 hours when the whereabouts of Larry, Debbie, and the Jenny Lee cannot be accounted for, so there would have been plenty of time for Larry to travel a couple of miles west to another location where Debbie was left to die in the water. If you're wondering why Larry would wait such a long period of time before coming to shore to call for help, it might be because causing someone to succumb to hypothermia is not exactly a quick way to commit murder. If the crime unfolded like the prosecution described, where Larry cut the life raft to deflate it, caused Debbie to sink into the freezing cold water, and then swam back to the Jenny Lee, he probably had to make sure the boat was a great distance away from Debbie to ensure she wouldn't be able to make it back there. Of course, Larry wouldn't want to return to shore and phone the Coast Guard if there was any chance Debbie was still alive, so he had to go back and confirm she was actually dead, and finding a body in the middle of the lake on a dark night is no easy task. I also think it's possible Larry could have spent some of this time disposing of evidence. Remember, it could not be conclusively established what Larry used to cut the raft. While a steak knife was found in his toolbox, it did not match the puncture marks, but since Larry owned a pair of diving knives which were never accounted for, the most logical explanation is that he used those and disposed of them somewhere. I'm not sure Larry simply tossed them into the water, because that would have run the risk of his story falling apart if the Coast Guard found a diving knife during their extensive search of the lake. I think this same logic applies to Larry's scuba gear, because even though he was caught in a lie about having it on board, the gear was still never found. So I think there's a good chance Larry traveled to a location outside the search area to get rid of this evidence and ensure no one would ever find it. There's also been some question about what happened to the gear bag containing Debbie's purse and valuables. I know that during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, Robert Stack said that Larry's family was planning to perform another search of Lake Superior for them, but even if these items were found, I'm not sure if they would prove or disprove Larry's story, as he simply could have tossed them into the lake himself to further his claims that Debbie lost them when she died. Now, when you look at all the facts, it is pretty apparent that Larry could have murdered his wife by abandoning her in the middle of the lake to freeze to death, but the question is, would he? Because even though Larry definitely had the motive, means, and opportunity to commit this crime, it's still an incredibly complicated and risky way to kill someone. I mean, what if another boat came along while Larry was doing this? Hypothermia does not cause instantaneous death, so what if someone else happened to find Debbie in the water and rescue her before she was dead? Well, if this case involved a couple who only went out on the water intermittently, I would be inclined to think that this type of murder plot was too absurd to be true. Yet it seems to fit the mold of someone like Larry Race, who would have had extensive knowledge of what prolonged exposure to cold water could do to a person. If he had a truly devious mind, I could see him using this knowledge to dream up a scenario in which he could murder his wife. I think the incident where the Jenny Lee sank and Larry had to drag his daughters to safety in a life raft planted these seeds in his head. He may have finally reached the point where he really wanted to escape an unhappy marriage and figured that if the same situation repeated itself with Debbie, it would just look like an accident. I mean, if Larry took Debbie out onto the boat, threw her into the water and drowned her, there would be a thorough investigation to determine if foul play had taken place. But if the cause of death was determined to be hypothermia, then it's a lot harder to prove there was premeditated murder. But to me, one of the biggest red flags which points to premeditation is when Larry approached the sheriff's deputy 3 days beforehand and asked him to perform a safety inspection on the Jenny Lee. Larry's defense team tried to say this supported his innocence because the deputy testified that Larry specifically told him he had 2 life rafts on board the boat. But let's look at this from another angle. When have you ever heard of someone voluntarily approaching a member of law enforcement and asking them to perform a safety inspection on their boat? I mean, you're potentially opening yourself up to a situation where they find a bunch of other safety violations you don't even know about. And given that Larry had spent months doing extensive repair work salvaging the Jenny Lee after it had sunk to the bottom of the lake, this could have proved problematic for him. To me, I think Larry planned this whole thing in the event that he ran into legal trouble down the line because he wanted a credible witness to support his claims about 2 life rafts. In my eyes, the inability to find a second raft is the one hurdle which makes it very difficult to believe Larry is completely innocent in this whole affair. I know that Lake Superior is a big place, but the Coast Guard's search and rescue teams were pretty certain that if the raft had been out there, they would have found it, since there's no way it could have completely sank to the bottom. I know we had witnesses come forward a decade later who claimed they found a raft washed up on shore around that time, but I have a feeling that it was a completely different raft which had no connection to this case. I think this is a situation where Larry got too clever for his own good. If he left the raft in the water alongside Debbie and it was found by the Coast Guard, there would be no plausible way to explain the cuts and punctures he made on there to deflate it. So he had to take the raft back to the Jenny Lee and fabricate a story about it having been damaged on a previous occasion and hope that the authorities would buy a story. But the positioning of the cuts, as well as the closed air chambers, created a lot of suspicion that this was done intentionally and compelled them to pursue murder charges. Contrary to what Larry says, I don't think Debbie panicked when she saw the engine was leaking and assumed the boat was going to sink. I think he staged the whole thing to give Debbie the false impression that the boat was sinking in order to convince her to get into the raft. Since Larry had previously rescued their daughters by putting on a dry suit and dragging their raft ashore, he probably told Debbie he was going to do the same thing again, and she had no reason to doubt it. But this time, Larry went underwater and slashed the raft, causing Debbie to wind up in the lake, while her husband abandoned her to freeze to death. Larry either took the damaged raft back to the boat with him, or returned to the scene to retrieve it after Debbie was already dead. If this is what actually happened, then it was a pretty cruel and sadistic plan, because succumbing to hypothermia is a terrible thing to experience, and Debbie would not have died quickly. Now, it's easy to believe that Larry is guilty of murder, but the more controversial question is, was this proven beyond a reasonable doubt at his trial? Well, that one is a bit more iffy, since the case against him was pretty circumstantial. While you can disagree with Jean Aubineau's assessment about it being impossible for Debbie's body to have drifted to the location where she was found, he does bring up a valid point about it being very difficult for Larry to have pulled off all the physical feats the prosecution described. But you also have to take into account that Larry was an incredibly skilled diver and swimmer who had probably swam in Lake Superior hundreds of times before that point. An average man probably wouldn't have been able to pull off a plan like this, which involved extensive swimming and diving, but I think Larry could have. I also think some people downplay the significance of the dry suit Larry had on. At trial, a hypothermia expert testified that a diver in a dry suit could stay in 37-degree water almost indefinitely without developing hypothermia, so I don't find it unbelievable that Larry would have been capable of swimming back and forth from his boat and going underwater to slash the life raft. I have to say, I was completely prepared to be skeptical of the prosecution's case when John DeSanto's interview on Unsolved Mysteries started off with him saying that the story was inappropriate for the show because it was not an unsolved mystery. That does come across as arrogant, but as the segment goes on, I do think DeSanto builds up quite a bit of credibility. Whenever Larry's defense attorneys bring up points in their interviews, which they believe favor his innocence, DeSanto responds with counterpoints, which do sound pretty logical. And when you look at the defense's case as a whole, you realize that they just do not do a very effective job at explaining away many of the discrepancies in Larry's story, which I really don't think can be ignored. Right after he was convicted, I really think Larry was grasping at straws when he hired new attorneys and filed an appeal on the grounds that he had ineffective counsel because his lawyers wouldn't let him testify on his own behalf. Well, if you followed enough murder trials, you'll know that it's fairly common for the defendant to not testify, even when there's a very convincing case for their innocence. Larry's original defense attorney maintained that Larry did not even want to take the stand, and I have a feeling that if he did, DeSanto would have eaten him alive. Now, it must be said that just because Larry was an adulterer does not mean he's a murderer, and he may have had a valid point when he said that his affairs unfairly influenced the jury. But personally, even without the infidelity, I think there was enough convincing evidence to show that Larry's story did not hold up, and that he likely murdered his wife. It is interesting that even though he received a life sentence, Larry was able to get paroled after serving 22 years. I've heard that when Larry made his first attempt at parole after 17 years, he was denied because he would not admit guilt in front of the parole board. It's usually very difficult for convicted murderers to get paroled unless they admit what they did, but I see no indication that Larry confessed to the murder before he was released in 2005. Whatever the case, he must have somehow convinced the parole board that he was fit to re-enter society. If by chance he really was wrongfully convicted, then I am glad he was able to become a free man again. But overall, I do not think Larry Race was innocent, and I do believe justice likely was served in this case, so I guess you could say, the trail did not go cold. Anyway, that wraps up this month's bonus episode. Thank you all so much for listening and supporting us on Patreon. Next month is going to officially mark our podcast's 3-year anniversary, and man, time has certainly flown by. Per usual, we've got a third anniversary show lined up to commemorate the occasion, but I've also got a special anniversary bonus episode planned for Patreon, which is almost going to function as a 3-year retrospective for this podcast. So have yourself a good month, and join us again in February for a special anniversary bonus episode of the trail went cold.
We'll be right back.